supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got a super jam-packed, spectacular show for you this week, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we'll talk about fertilizers, specifically why 10-10-10 is not the correct numbers for any plant whatsoever, especially a failing tree. We're also going to talk to Dr. Mary Gardner about the good garden bugs, everything you need to know about the beneficial predatory insects that are just waiting to take care of your pest control problems. That's a lot to get done. If we're going to take some phone calls, we better hop right to it at 1-888-346-9499. Ken, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you, Mike. I need your advice about another type of environment that we're not used to in the northern latitude, and that's high tropical grounds where I could organize small growers for blueberries in Central America.
Where are you now, Ken?
Right now I'm in Arizona and ready to go back home here in about 3 weeks.
And home is?
It's on halfway up 11,000-foot volcano in the center of Costa Rica.
Now, why blueberries in Costa Rica?
Well, I've been down there for 30 years, started with herbs and specialty vegetables, trying to find options for small growers to be able to keep their small plots of land. And this is just my latest thought once was blueberries, because I've heard that some places in Guatemala are doing it. And I imagine they're going to be like from out of the University of Alabama, that type of thing. But what seems to me to be the problem is the day length is one. The other, at high altitudes, we'll talk about, 9,000, 10,000 feet. We can get slight frost at some times. Being a farmer in northern Vermont, I've seen native blueberries be very short ones in northern Vermont on high altitudes, but that's a tremendously acid soil. In this particular case, the mountains are acid, and so I can go two ways. I did organize wild blackberries on the mountainside, and that's for production, and most of that's going to Germany.
Okay, but so you're doing blackberries there.
I've been doing that for a long time, but they were actually native varieties, Mike.
Yeah, but they still have a chilling requirement. So even though you've got us in this tropical rainforest concept, you have a cold season up on the mountain.
Yes, and it can freeze at times.
Okay? Well, blueberries love cold weather.
I know it.
Now, what is the season like up on the mountain?
You get 12 hours of day length, okay?
Right.
And then you have, depending on where you are on the mountainside, I mean, you would have, on the Caribbean side, you basically get moisture all year. And you can get up to 2 meters of moisture.
What kind of temperature?
Temperature stays. At altitudes, you have the high, if you'll be lucky to get 80 degrees.
Right.
76, 78 in there would be the high at the hottest time of the year. And the coldest, of course, would be at night, and it would get down maybe to 32 at times. But most of it would be in the 50s and possibly the mid-40s, that type of thing. Where I am located, I can go 15 miles as the eagle would fly, mm-hmm. down the volcano and over to the mountainside and have pineapple and go up and have Brussels sprouts.
Okay.
Okay, from that type of radius. So it's probably the most diverse type of place you could find on Earth in that way.
It sounds like you're going to get a lot of cool nights in some areas.
In the high altitude, yes.
And those chilling nights should provide your blueberries with what they need, which is a certain number of what are called chilling hours. And chilling hours don't necessarily mean below freezing. It's just temperatures below 45 degrees, and you need a couple hundred of them. So I would try some southern varieties, but I would also try just a number of basic high bush varieties, because inside those varieties, you have early, middle, and late blooming varieties. And
yes, sir.
In a normal climate, they would carry you through a long season of having berries available. In your climate, they might wind up almost fruiting all year. The key, again, is the acidic soil, and they need cool nights. And I hope they're still in business, but there used to be a specialty supplier called High Country Gardens.
Uh-huh.
And any blueberries that they would recommend would be okay. The varieties that you would want to look out for. But I'm thinking you just want to take like a dozen plants of every type of high bush, the early, the middle, the late, and you may get the kind of extended season that people only dream of.
I don't know what to say, but I really like your program. This is the first time I've been to the States in almost 30 years, and I lucked out listening to NPR and being able to catch you on Saturday mornings. I certainly appreciate it. Being an organic small farm mixed animal and grains and vegetable type of guy, your advice is absolutely precious, and thank you.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Okay, thank you, and have a great one.
Thank you. 1-888-346-9499. Amy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being had, Amy. Where are you?
I am in Sauk City, Wisconsin, which is on the northwest side of Madison.
Okay. So what can we do for Amy just outside of Madison?
My husband and I installed a rain barrel for the first time this year, and we have a vegetable garden, raised bed, and we're just wondering, because there's a lot of different answers online, is it actually safe to put that rain barrel water on our vegetable garden?
Yeah, otherwise, why would you have it? Now, Wisconsin generally has a lot of rain. Have you gone through any dry spells yet?
No, not yet this summer.
And is the rain barrel collecting water from your gutters?
Yes.
Okay. What do you do when it's full? What happens to the gutter water?
When it's all full, we just keep using it. We don't empty it out all the way.
Right.
We've had a lot of rain this summer so far, so it's pretty much always full.
Yeah, these rain barrels are much more useful in a climate that has limited rain or that goes through dry spells. If you've gotten a lot of rain, even though you've got this great source of non-city water, you have to be careful not to drown your plants. So rain barrels, again, are most effective in places that go through summer dry spells. You collect the water during rainstorms, and then, you know, a week or two later when your garden needs watering, hopefully you've got the barrel up high where gravity will allow it to just feed a drip line or something like that. How do you get your water out of your barrel?
We just fill up some watering buckets and throw it on the garden. We try not to put the water on the plants, obviously, and we water in the morning on the soil.
Good, good. Do you have any containers?
We don't, but we could get some.
Now, the more containers you have, containers, because they're above ground, they tend to dry out more rapidly. And that's a great thing when your barrel's up high enough that you can fit a watering can underneath. Then you can use the water from the rain barrel to water the containers. And the big advantages are, again, of course, in a climate that has a lot of dry spells. But also, if you have city water that's chlorinated and has fluoride in it, that water isn't the best for your plants, whereby rainwater doesn't have any of those adulterants in it. So that's one of the big advantages. But what are your concerns? What have you read that leads you to believe it's not safe to use?
Just that there might be some unsafe contaminants and bacteria in the water coming from the roof, so bird poop and stuff like that going into the water. But I kind of figured that our birds go to the bathroom on our garden anyway. So
bird poop is an excellent fertilizer. Guano is very high in nitrogen. You'd be using homeopathic amounts. It would just be a little nutrient. Now, obviously, that's why it's not drinking water.
Right.
But generally, the concern on a roof is you get a little bit of shingle debris. And generally, that's why the water in these rain barrels, the spout, is a couple inches above the bottom so that, you know, the debris drops down to the bottom. It's below the spout. It kind of filters out the same as in a septic tank where the solids go down, the liquids stay high. And you've got screening on top to prevent mosquito breeding, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the answer is basically that the water is very good. However, I will warn you that after a period of time, if it just sits there not being used, it can begin to turn into what's called black water. It can kind of go bad just by sitting there in the sun. So if everything is working out and you got all the rain you need and you really don't need the barrel and you know some rain is coming up, it wouldn't be a bad idea to drain it and let it refill, say, just once a month, something like that. Keep the water nice and fresh. But otherwise, it's great. And if you get a dry spell, you're a genius.
Perfect.
All right, Amy?
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear at the Spring City Library in Chester County on Friday evening, September 11th, and at the Horsham Township Library on Wednesday evening, September 16th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to take a long look at beneficial bugs, just say no to 101010, and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we'll take a look at soil test recommendations and why you should just say no to 101010 or 20-20-20. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our very special guest, Dr. Mary Gardner, author of the new book, Good Garden Bugs, everything you need to know about beneficial predatory insects, our best friends in the garden. Dr. Gardner, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for being here. I have to say that over my time at Organic Gardening Magazine and here on You Bet Your Garden, beneficial insects are us. It is one of our favorite topics. And one thing I keep trying to explain to people is if you get all the good bugs coming to your garden, you really aren't going to have the kind of bad bug problems that people who have who spray insecticides.
That's right. So when you use insecticides, of course, you not only kill the pest insects, but you also harm a lot of non-target insects, including beneficials. And so you end up, if pests recolonize, they're not being that group of beneficial predators and parasitoids that you need to keep them in check. So enhancing your garden as a habitat for these insects can create a more sustainable and manageable level of pest insects throughout the season.
When I give my talks on attracting beneficial insects, obviously number one is just don't use pesticides. I mean, as you point out, they're very detrimental to the beneficial insects, but I don't think they hurt the bad bugs anymore. Sometimes, like, spraying 7 on a stink bug is like giving them a Flintstones vitamin. They just, you know, perk up a little bit.
Well, unfortunately, some pest insects have developed resistance to certain insecticides, so certainly you can see reduced efficacy in cases when you're using pesticides. And typically, our beneficial insects don't have that same level of resistance, so they're going to have more mortality in cases.
And in many cases, the part that makes me really sad is that a lot of times people will simply spray because something's moving in their garden. And I can't tell you how many people who have accurately reported to me what a great job they did, and I've identified that they wiped out a cluster of ladybug eggs or a green lacewing larva.
Well, that's true. If you can't identify the pest and beneficials, then it makes it very difficult to be able to scout and to manage your garden for pests. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write this book about predators and parasitoids, because they are difficult to identify without a resource. We wanted to include a lot of pictures so that people could figure out what these unknowns were before they made a management decision.
Now, I do want to talk about the plantings and other things that we can do in our gardens to bring these creatures in, but I'm going to go out of order in your book, and I'm going to go right to the field guide, because everybody knows ladybugs. If they've been listening to this show, they know about lacewings, and then there's other names I'll throw out there that I honestly think they feel I'm making up. You know, the minute pirate bug. Come on. You know, that can't be right.
It's legit. So the minute pirate bug, as the name suggests, is a tiny insect. It's just a couple millimeters long. It has black and white wing patches, and it's a piercing sucking insect, so it will stab prey with its piercing beak and then suck out the liquid contents.
Arg! Arg! Die, you potato beetle! Die, you stink bug!
Exactly.
The big-eyed bug.
Well, people can probably get a little bit of an image of what this insect looks like. It does have two very large eyes. Otherwise, it looks a little bit like the minute pirate bug. It's a little bit larger, maybe about 5 millimeters in length, with these large eyes that are clearly visible when you're looking at the insect.
Some of them look remarkably like things that you couldn't blame people for thinking are pests. The two spotted stink bug, which looks a little bit like a harlequin bug.
It does. The two-spotted stink bug, though, is a really great one to have in the garden because it's a Colorado potato beetle predator.
There you go. Go.
So if you find a stink bug that's has a black body with bright coloration along the edges of the body on your potatoes, definitely let it be, because that's going to be consuming the eggs and larvae of the potato beetle.
I love ambush bugs, and here's the fanboy in me, because DC Comics years ago came out with one of the stupidest characters ever, and it's a hapless superhero called the Ambush Bug, and they actually made them look like the real ones. But these are great predators in the garden.
They are. I'm going to have to look up that superhero, but ambush bugs are really cool looking. They're often have spines or sort of sharp edges sort of along their wing covers, and many have enlarged front legs. You can see how they would use those for grasping their prey. And they're often sit-and-wait predators, so they're going to wait until something comes within range and then grasp it with those legs.
Now, you got a lot of cool-looking bugs, and you've got great pictures of them. And many are more colorful than this, but nothing is more, can we say, unrealistic, like she made this up, or, you know, see, CGI'd it, as the wheel bug. Come on. What is the wheel bug about? This is hilarious. I wish we could hold it up and people could see it on the radio.
So the wheel bug was my laboratory pet a couple years ago. These are really fascinating to watch, and they're big. They're more than an inch in length. And they're a gray insect. They have a narrow head with a very pronounced beak. So this is a piercing predator. It pierces its prey with its beak. And then they're called the wheel bug because they have this half wheel of thorns along the top of their thorax. And the thorns look like half of a spoke of a wheel.
And it looks, I mean, it looks more like a wheel than even you're describing. It's like some kid stuck a poker chip in this poor insect.
It really does. It's a neat-looking insect for sure.
I try to make the distinction when people ask about praying mantises in the garden and spiders. I go, well, they're generally good, but they're just basic predators. They will attack anything, including some good bugs and some pollinators. But there is a class of the, I guess you'd call it the really most sincerely beneficial, that only prey upon pest insects. And in many cases, the pest insect is the only thing that this creature ever gets to eat.
Yeah, so good garden bugs in this book range from highly generalized, like you said, insects that will feed on basically anything that they can catch, to very specialized. And one of the most specialized groups are the parasitoids. So parasitoid wasps typically attack only one type of prey or a small number of different types of prey.
It is my understanding when, and again, this was something I learned recently, you know, we have the marmorated stink bug now that has exploded on the scene and is causing a lot of mischief on my tomatoes and peach trees and things like that. And then, of course, overwintering in people's homes. And we had a researcher, an entomologist on the show, explain that one of these miniature wasps, and again, we need to remind people that these wasps, some of them are so small, they're the size of the period at the end of a sentence in a newspaper. These are not wasps that can impact us in any way. But there was a specific predatory wasp from, I believe, Korea that only preys on this version of the stink bug.
Yeah, so that's a form of importation biological control. So what happens a lot with these invasive pest insects is that when they're introduced accidentally into a new area, they come without their predators, without their pathogens, without anything that's going to control their abundance. And so we see this huge population increase, as we have with the brown marmorated stink bug. And so I think in that case, researchers are looking at introducing a parasitoid wasp as a means to reduce the abundance of the stink bug here in the U.S.
And these tiny wasps that we're talking about work in, it's my understanding, in one of two ways. They either inject their eggs into the pest insect or they lay their eggs on the outside of the pest insect. And then the pest that's been bothering you in the garden gets a send-off from the movie Alien eventually.
That's what happens. So they'll either, with wasp parasitoids, they have what looks like a stinger but is actually an ovipositor or egg-laying organ, and so that ovipositor allows them to sting their prey and deposit an egg within it. Some wasps or flies will lay their eggs on their prey, and then the larvae will hatch from those eggs and enter the insect, and some parasitoids even lay their eggs directly on plant material, hoping that their host will consume the eggs during feeding, and some of the undamaged eggs then hatch once they're inside the pest. Once the eggs hatch, one or more larvae will emerge per pest, and those larvae will consume the pest from the inside out in an alien-like way, and then they will pupate either inside the host or outside, sometimes on it, and then emerge as adults.
You would pay, if you could, to be out there to see your caterpillars explode when the day comes.
I've seen it happen with cucumber beetles. So there's a fly parasitoid that attacks cucumber beetles. And when the cocoon forms inside the cucumber beetle, the beetle literally explodes. So its head pops out and the cocoon or pupa of the parasitoid shoots out of the cucumber beetle. And we have a picture of that from our lab in the book.
We will have this up. This is going to go viral. This is going to beat my TED Talk on YouTube. I want the exploding cucumber beetle. I can hear our listeners who grow cukes cheering out there.
Oh, absolutely. They're such a pest, and you spend so much time removing them from the plant. So it's great to see something like that out there.
Again, in terms of these very tiny wasps, these beneficial wasps, many people have seen an example in their garden. on the tomato hornworm. When I was first gardening, I was an organic gardener from day one, simply because I didn't know there were any options. I didn't want to buy anything. I just, got plants and seeds. And what a shock, the plants grew really well. And I thought that the tomato hornworms actually came with those white spines on their back. I thought that's what they looked like. I thought, whoa, that's a really cool thing for an insect to have.
Well, it's showing that you had a very productive garden with a lot of parasitoids in it. So if people notice a hornworm with white cocoons, they're covered with sort of a web-like, like spider web-type material. They look sort of cottony. These cocoons are going to be hatching into parasitoids. So you just want to leave that caterpillar alone. It's not going to be doing any more damage to the plant at that point, and then allow them to emerge.
Your picture of a robber fly. You got little Groucho glasses somewhere and put it on this tiny insect, didn't you? They don't really look like that.
Robber flies are cool. No, we had a lot of great pictures. So we worked with a large number of photographers. That was one of the real challenges of doing a book like this. And the website bugguide.net is a great resource for people to check out. That's where we got most of our photos, and it's a website managed by Iowa State University where people can post pictures of unknown insects and experts will help identify them.
So let's talk about habitat. One thing that I don't talk about on the show nearly as much as I should are ground beetles. And again, this is an insect that people look at and they're probably a little scared of. But ground beetles, I've been led to believe, are second only to toads in the number of things they can consume at ground level.
Oh, absolutely. Ground beetles are very common and they're very important in garden habitats. Ground beetles can range from pretty tiny, just a few millimeters, up to a couple of centimeters in total size. So they're very large to very small. Most are either black or brown and shiny or metallic. And they oftentimes have wing covers or elytra that have striations or indentations that run over the length of them. And although they're ground beetles, there are species that climb trees or plants looking for their pests. But most of them are going to be found on the soil surface or in mulch. And the larvae are found a little bit below ground, feeding below ground on pests.
Do they prey on slugs or do they just prey on soft-bodied insects?
Their food varies a little bit between the species, but there are species that feed on snails and slugs, caterpillars, other beetle larvae, fly larvae, all sorts of different insect pests. Also, some species eat weed seeds.
Oh, excellent.
I need more of those in my own garden.
Yeah. Let's start breeding the weed-eating beetle and let it go. And the ladybug is not a bug of any kind. That's actually a proper terminology, right? The ladybug is a beetle.
The ladybug is a beetle. So if you go to the UK, it's a ladybird. Here in the US, it's a ladybug, but they're both actually a lady beetle.
And again, as you said, to have ground beetles around, just have places for them to hide.
Yes. So there's all sorts of habitat management strategies that a gardener can take to increase the abundance of beneficial insects. So this can range from things like making insectary plantings, which you mentioned, or adding mulch or other ground cover to create a more complex habitat for ground-dwelling species, influencing how you manage your lawn and allowing for some flowering plants within a lawn is a great way. Providing overwintering and shelter resources. So there's many steps that we can take.
But you also lead the book off with exactly what I think people want to know. Just cut to the chase. Tell me what to plant. And you have what you call the sweet seven right up front. Dill. I've always been told dill is like the poster child for attracting beneficial insects to your garden.
Oh, if you observe dill for a couple of minutes, you'll see that it's teeming with lots of different predatory insects and parasitoids feeding on pollen and nectar.
And again, but you have to let it flower. That is one of the issues with these culinary herbs that are great beneficial insect attractors, because most of us keep pinching off the flowers to keep the flavor good. But you want, I always tell people, grow twice as much and let the other half go to flower.
Yeah, that's a great strategy. You could create an edge planting of something like dill and coriander and allow it to bolt. And then keep other plantings at bay so that, you know, you can continue to harvest those. But I know my cilantro always bolts, and I think people's tendency is to take it out, but it's really an attractive plant for beneficial insects, so something to keep around. Not everyone realizes how many insects feed on pollen and nectar, so we think about bees doing that, but lady beetles, spiders, all sorts of predators feed on these resources, and they need them to survive.
Excellent, excellent advice. A great book, fabulous photographs. I learned something from it, Cats and Kittens, so I'm sure it's going to be an inspiration to many gardeners. This is really like taking, you know, beneficial insects 101. There's a lot of useful information here. All right, the name of the book is Good Garden Bugs, Everything You Need to Know About Beneficial Predatory Insects. The author is Mary Gardner, Dr. Mary Gardner, and the book is brand new from Quarry Publishers. It gets our highest recommendation. Mary, Dr. Gardner, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I am coming to Dayton. I'll do a special WYSO member event Friday evening, October 2nd, and a big public event on Saturday, October 3rd. But don't go offering me a ride back to the airport just yet, because we'll be right back to say no to 101010 and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, makers of Biotone Starter Plus for new transplants, full of beneficial microbes and mycorrhiza for deeper roots and stronger plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in this stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll tell you why fertilizers with numbers on the label like 101010 and 202020 are unbalanced, and why you should never use anything like that on a young plant or a sick plant, or quite honestly, any plant. We'll tell you all about it after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Patty, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Patty. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I am just ducky today. Thank you. Where is Patty Good?
I'm in the Roxborough section of Philadelphia, but I'm calling for my parents who are in North Wales, PA.
Okay, both just outside of Philadelphia. What's eating your parents?
So I'm calling because my parents just recently went on vacation, and they had me come over water their plants. And one of the tasks I had was to shake their cherry tree. which is a newer cherry tree. It's probably like 6 or 7 feet tall, and it has beetles all over it. So I went over, shook the beetles off, and then they flew right back on.
And
killing the tree.
Right. And these are Japanese beetles?
Yeah. So they have those little, like, trap things.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, you got to get rid of the traps.
Oh.
They're attracting the beetles to the trees.
Okay.
Japanese beetle traps attract 4 times the number of beetles to a given area than would occur there normally, and they can only trap half of the beetles. So when you put the traps out, you effectively double their numbers.
Yeah, so should they put their traps somewhere else on their property, or just not at all?
Yeah, well, there are feelings that you can put them at the outskirts to kind of intercept them. But yes, nowhere near roses, cherries, grapevines, raspberries, you know, the plants that Japanese beetles go for.
Okay. Is there any other way to keep the beetles off of the cherry tree?
Yes, and it's absolutely brand new. Now, I have to make a little disclaimer because Gardens Alive supports the Question of the Week feature we have on the show. But Gardens Alive has also been in the forefront of funding new discoveries in organic pest management. I believe they actually paid the EPA registration to get corn gluten meal on the market years and years ago. And they have just released a new BT. I don't know if you listen to the show, if you know about BT. BT is a naturally occurring soil organism, and
Okay. There's
lots of different subspecies. One of them kills caterpillars who eat the sprayed leaves. Another one is in those little dunks you throw in standing water. It prevents mosquitoes from breeding there.
Okay.
This is called BTG for Galleria. And if you spray it on your parents' cherry trees, the beetles will immediately die after eating the sprayed leaves, but it affects nothing else. It doesn't hurt birds, butterflies, frogs, toads, people, pets. All of the BTs are very specific, and the insect has to eat the sprayed leaves to be killed. So,
Okay. And
of course, Gardens Alive has this habit of creating funny names for everything. So you don't have to remember BT. It's called Beetlejuice.
Okay.
So if you go to the Gardens Alive website, they have 2 versions of this BT. One that you spray on plants under attack, and then another one that you dust into the ground. And that prevents, because, you know, they're mating up there and then they're laying eggs right underneath the tree.
Okay.
And the other form of this BTG prevents the grubs from developing underground. So you get the eaters and you get the next generation and you don't harm anything. These BTs are very specific. This is a huge breakthrough. Probably 5-6 years from now, it'll be available from a number of sources. But right now, Gardens Alive is the only place that sells it.
All right, cool. So the newest thing. That sounds good.
All right. Good luck, Patty.
All right. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Lynn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. I could talk to you.
Oh, it's good to talk to you, Lynn. Where are you?
Just south of Easton, north of Bucks County.
Okay. I know where Easton is. ABE, Allentown, Bethlehem, and Easton.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, what can we do? And Easton is happening these days, Lynn. You got one of the best farmers markets in the country there on Saturday morning.
And also on Wednesday evenings now, too. So it's a great place to grow. I mean, it may be a little too good. We have a problem with a gigantic silver maple. It's 200-plus years old. It's unfortunately, it's an old neighborhood, so it's sandwiched between a very busy road and my house. And it overhangs utility lines and, you know, all that. And it needs a maintenance, but the quotes I'm getting are just astronomical, like, you know, $10,000. And I've been laid off for over a year. So I was hoping that there's some suggestions to get either some low-cost maintenance or, you know, it would kill me to take it down. But even that, the cost of that is astronomical. So.
Oh, yeah, the cost of removing a tree that size so close to property is unbelievable. But if it's in the power lines, you won't bear that cost. Now, I made the mistake on the show a couple of weeks ago when talking about silver maples. I called them trash trees, which is still my opinion. I said that they were fast-growing, brittle, and short-lived. And I had an arborist contact me after the show and say, you got two out of three. They, you know, they're fast-growing and they're brittle, but they can have a very long life.
It looks pretty healthy. I mean, it's, it needs some suckers taken off, and it's got ivy on it. But it doesn't have, like, a lot of dead branches. It doesn't shed a lot of branches in the storms. But
well,
it just, you know,
and
if it's a maintenance, it's going to be a problem.
Well, okay. Well, and but you say it's growing up into the power lines.
It's not the electric lines. It's growing over, like, the phone and cable lines.
Right, because the true power line tends to be a single exposed strand way above all those other communications wires.
It's on the other side of the street, actually.
Oh, okay. So the power company doesn't care about you.
No.
You say it's not dropping a lot of branches. You say it has suckers and ivy.
Yes.
Well, the ivy will lead to the decline of the tree, but you don't need any special help in getting rid of the ivy. And it's not poison ivy, is it?
There's a little of that, but I'm dealing with it. It's mostly English ivy.
Because
I tried the trimming around the bottom, and it really just kind of annoys it, but it doesn't kill it.
Right, but it kills the ivy that has already grown on the tree.
Just seems to kind of annoy it. And I'm also concerned that I'm going to, you know, damage the tree.
No, you can cut through the ivy where it comes up out of the ground. It can't absorb any nutrients from the tree. It's an epiphyte, not a parasite. It's just holding on to the tree.
Right.
So if you just keep cutting down low to the base of the tree, all the ivy that's up in the tree will brown up and die and wither away. That'll be good for the health of the tree. You know, the two things that ivy does, a mass of ivy can block sunlight to the leaves of the tree, but more importantly, really pervasive ivy around the outsides can keep the bark moist, and that'll lead to the destruction
right.
of the tree. And you say the tree is sending up suckers.
Yeah, it's got a pretty good amount of suckering going on.
I don't know what you're physically capable of, what kind of neighbors, but really, all you got to do is get what's called a bow saw. It's like a $10, $12 tool. It's very easy to use, doesn't need a lot of hand strength. And again, just saw those off low to the ground.
Oh, I've been talking about that, like they're coming off the branches, not out of the ground.
Oh,
like,
so, yes, those are called water sprouts.
Water sprouts, okay.
And, you know, they're not good for the tree, but they're not something that you have to really worry about. Because you say the canopy of the tree is doing fine.
Yeah, it looks good. I mean, I go down the road a bit, I can see the top of it, and it looks pretty healthy.
Okay, good, good, good. So why are you concerned? Are you just thinking about the future?
I'm thinking long term. It's not going to get any cheaper.
Well, you shouldn't be spending any money on this tree. The cutting of the ivy is really all you need to be doing, and that's just a couple of cuts a couple of times a year. Otherwise, the tree should be fine. When you start to notice dead wood, that's the time where you'll want to call the power company, and either they'll come out and trim it for you if they think it could impact their lines, or they'll tell you who owns the cable lines and the phone lines, and they'll send a crew out. You know, they've got the trucks to do this, and if the lines are right there on the tree, it's not so much that it's their responsibility. They don't want you or private workers up there. You could knock out the power to all of Easton. You could knock out everybody's cable TV during the World Series. You know, they will come and take care of it. It comes to that. All that I would suggest for you to keep this tree healthy is to just keep getting away at that ivy. Don't let that ivy keep growing up the tree. And again, once you sever it down by the root zone, the ivy in the tree will die. You don't have to do anything with it. It'll just fall apart on its own.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thanks very much.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Soil tests, sick trees, and fertilizers. Why 10-10-10 is not the answer to anything. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started with this week's question.
Sure, Mike. George in Norristown, PA writes, I've been having issues with a pin oak, and one of the suggested fixes was an application of 10-10-10. I had a bit left over afterward and sprinkled some around two 10-inch high cherry tomato plants as an experiment. All my other plants kept growing, but the two I gave the 10-10-10 to looked stunned, wilted, and are now about to expire. How could, quote, fertilizer be the end of these plants?
Well, first we asked George where he got the advice to give chemical fertilizer to an ailing tree.
Quote, it was recommended by the lab at Penn State after they ran a soil test for me.
So I called the director of the lab, and he agreed with my assertion that when a tree is failing, the first thing you got to do is look at its physical environment. Commercial arborists have been warning for years that piling mulch up against the trunk, that so-called decorative mulching, is the biggest cause of tree problems and premature tree death.
But everybody does it.
And almost everybody used to smoke. And covering the bark of a tree with chipped wood makes just as much sense as the ashtrays that used to be next to every hospital bed in America.
Okay, so you should remove the mulch before you even think about a soil test or a fertilizer. But what if there isn't any mulch on the trunk?
If the tree is growing near a lawn that's being treated with herbicides, you gotta suspect that the herbicides are doing their job, and that's to kill any plant that isn't grass. Fertilizer isn't going to help there, and it won't help a tree that was planted in a wet spot either.
So is lack of food ever the problem?
My experience is that trees are pretty good at feeding themselves. They got these deep roots to find water and nutrients down low, and lots of leaves up high to collect the solar energy that helps the tree use that food efficiently. And if food was necessary, it would not be in the form of the ubiquitous 10-10-10, 20-20-20, or any of the other so-called balanced chemical salts.
Wait a second. Three tens isn't balanced?
Only in the mind of the person buying the fertilizer. As you know, by law, all fertilizers must have three numbers on the label, their NPK rating. The N stands for the total amount of nitrogen in the bag or bottle, while the P and the K, the phosphorus and potassium, represent the amounts of those nutrients that will be available to the plants in the first year.
The first year?
Yeah, nitrogen gets used up fast, but phosphorus and potassium persist in the soil for several years, so there's no need to keep adding them every time you fertilize. In fact, there's good reason not to, as they can build up to levels that can cause serious problems, especially if you fertilize more than once a year. And no plant uses equal amounts of those three nutrients. Research has shown that a truly balanced fertilizer for flowering plants would have a ratio of 3-1-2. So a 6-2-4 on a label would be perfect. For lawns, it would be all or almost all nitrogen, something like a 9-0-0.
And what about trees?
I just can't wrap my head around the idea of feeding a tree. If there was ever a poster child for just give it a little bit of compost, it'd be a tree.
Okay. So what happened to the tomato plants?
Oh, at 10 inches high, those tomato plants were still babies. I suspect that the powerful chemical salts in the 10-10-10 burned them up. Too much nitrogen can burn any plant, especially young plants. Although the director of the soil lab feels strongly that the fertilizer itself was safe and that our listener must have used too much.
Why did the soil lab recommend the fertilizer in the first place?
That's what they do. Most of the land-grant universities that handle soil tests for their individual states were established with fees collected on fertilizer sales, and many still have a very pro-chemical bias. In this specific case, our listener's soil tested a little low in nutrients, so the lab recommended a common form of chemical fertilizer that they knew would be easy for him to find. 10-10-10 may not make any sense to a sustainable advocate like me, but it is widely available.
And the lab didn't offer an organic option?
Not out of the box. You have to ask for it up front. And even then, I got to say, I'm not quite sure what you're going to get in response. And any organic advice you do get is going to vary greatly from state to state. The bottom line is that these labs are essential for testing soils for lead and other contaminants. And they're a great low-cost way to learn the pH of your soil and information about some of its nutrients. But folks who want to have an organic, sustainable landscape should take the recommendations they provide with a grain of chemical salts. Well, that sure was some good advice about testing your soil, but then being temperate about the recommendations, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to call me with three tens if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email with your location. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore. With your location. At garden@whyy.org. Please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location, but where you will find the answers to all those garden questions you have for me, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our perpetually popular podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Lunes, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz keeps our website up and running. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia and is not prepared for me to see her three tens and raise her six aces. Our editor, Al Banks, wishes to check my cards. Our intern, Stephen, Dre like the horse, hoe like the tool, and bull like the farm animal, may look like a kid, but he's got eight aces. Says it's got something to do with social media. Al, do cards on an iPhone count? I'm Mike McGrath, and if this were winter when I'd be wearing long sleeves and boots, I'd have more aces than Carter's got pills, or sweaters, or Billy Beer. You know, I once had Hunter Thompson offer me $20 for a Billy Beer, and it was not for its collectible value either. So put aside your fear and loathing, ante up, and I'll see you next week. What can you expect to hear next week? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I have no idea what we're going to do. Only that it will be fun and that I will get into trouble. Plus your fabulous phone calls.